You're listening to the podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, Audio Boom, and thepodcast.co.uk. And if you're listening, I'm so sorry. Or, you know, leave a review or something. Thanks.
Welcome to the podcast with a K.
Hey, what do you think about this for a new theme tune? I'm surprised no one's used it for a theme tune before, frankly.
Is there permission to use it? Like, do we have to worry about that stuff?
I think he's joking, Brian.
Oh. I thought he meant like borrowing it for a theme tune, but okay.
Oh, no, no. So it's the podcast with a K. We are unaffiliated with any website other than thepodcast.co.uk. Joining me, Christian Corley, this week are James Terranova and Brian McLean. And you might want to rearrange those slightly and get the right people. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Hey.
What was that? Was that a Philadelphia accent, or are you just feeling very relaxed?
I was reading an email, not yours.
Right. Okay.
I was reading an email from that website we're not affiliated with.
Okay.
Wondering whether to ruin Philip's day and agree to do a review, which will take me several months more than I actually promise.
Oh, you probably should. It's always good to ruin Philip's day.
I know.
Bless him. Lovely lad. Hey, listen, guys. We did a Christmas podcast, and then we took a week off, and we brought you, dear listener, a re-release of one of our old cult casts, which discusses what was going on with the Saints back in 2014 when I spoke to Ian Dixon. It was really interesting stuff. Quite a short podcast. If you haven't picked it up already, it's only 24 minutes long. And it's proved surprisingly popular. So I'm glad about that. So we're going to release some other old cult casts later. But it got me thinking that, you know, we haven't really had kind of like a bit of a social catch-up on the podcast. So did any of you guys get anything like cool for Christmas or anything that you'd wish to share?
That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, no sex toys. Keep those to yourselves.
Well, I'm out. I got the confession dial from Series 9 from Nick Roboto.
Did you have to fight your way out of it?
Well, that was the hardest present to unwrap, let me tell you. Yes.
Okay. What about you, Jones? You got anything cool?
I'm just trying to think if I've got anything that I want to tell anyone about. I've become particularly secretive in my old age. No sex toys, just... I don't know, we just disclose so much about our lives these days, don't we? Even down to confession dials, which by its name is a rather unusual thing to confess, I guess, but...
Damn, you're so right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I must admit, what I found interesting this year was, apart from a couple of a DVD collection I wanted that was that isn't actually on any of the sort of VODs, I didn't really go for any DVDs this year because virtually everything now is so VOD'd.
Yeah,
you know, it's interesting to have a year where, you know, you're not thinking, oh, I'd like to ask for a DVD or something, because don't really need them as much anymore.
Do you know what I hate about video on demand? Is
What's
when
that?
It costs the same as a DVD.
Oh, right. So what, yeah, if you're actually hiring out. I was thinking more of the actual players rather than doing individual purchases.
Right. Well, what I was thinking of, right, is on Amazon, I could get The Lion King for £9.99 on Amazon Instant Video. Or
okay.
I could pop to the store just 5 minutes from this theatre and get the DVD for $7.99.
Well, I think, yeah, when you're going down those routes, sometimes it can be nice, but it's nice not to sort of be piling up stuff on your mantelpiece or your bookshelf, you know, thinking, you know, because it gets to the point where you think, how am I going to wedge something else in this Christmas?
Yeah.
It wasn't so much that much of an issue, this. Mm. I did get a really weird watch, actually.
All right, you too.
Which... sadly, the one time when we would be doing a live one, it'd be quite useful, and we're not for the camera. It's a sort of like a plastic sort of bracelet, a little akin to sort of like the Liberator Blake 7 one, but it's It has a light up display.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rather cool, but it's really difficult to read. I mean, I had it upside down initially, and it just looked like code, and I was sort of vaguely irritated.
Is it a smartwatch? Or
just... No, it's just a sort of almost like a bangly thing, like a Liberator bracelet. It's that sort of plasticky. But yeah, it was the most unusual present I think I got, and probably the most interesting one to sort of say on here. I can't really think of anything particularly pertinent to this podcast.
Oh, everything's pertinent to the podcast these days. Listen, I was very pleased. I didn't get this mug. I didn't get that for Christmas. However, I did get Michael Palin, The Python Years Diaries.
Okay.
Which is really good read. I also got the Monty Python DVD box set from a couple of years ago, so it's all been remastered. And there's a few extra things in there, which I haven't looked at yet. But what I have looked at is, and Brian's going to be bewildered, and we're going to lose half the listeners on this next section, this next description. I got a DVD collection of Says Les, which is a series from the 1970s from Yorkshire Television, starring Les Dawson. And some of those have got John Cleese in them. And there's some cracking sketches in them. They're a very strange sort of variety show. You basically get about 10 minutes of Les Dawson, 10 minutes of music, and it's like in a half-hour slot. And then the rest of it would obviously be taken up with adverts. But a lot of those are missing. There's the first two series of those shows, Yorkshire TV lost. So they only have the second two series, but they're very good. There's some good visual gags in there. Anyone who knows Les Dawson from later stuff, like he hosted Bankety Blank, didn't he, for instance, and did his famous Les Dawson show on BBC One, which is more of a consistent experience. They'll still find something interesting in these. So if you do catch sight of Says Les on DVD, I would recommend you pick it up. There's a superb sketch with Kenneth Connor, who was in, obviously he was a Carry-On person. And for Brian's reference, Kenneth Connor was in an episode of Blackadder the Third, the one with the two actors. He was one of the actors.
Okay.
In which Connor and Les Dawson go through those discussions that Fry and Laurie used to have over, like, when they're sort of like tearing something apart, those two critics.
They're
kind of preempting that, and they're doing a critique on comedy, and where like real comedy is really in sort of like speech and in timing and all that sort of stuff. But whilst they're doing this, they're doing slapstick stuff to each other, like squirting water at each other, putting axle grease over each other's heads, and pouring flour and detonating a bomb. It's a very, very funny sketch. I've never seen it before. I'm going to be sharing it.
Like, it's interesting you're saying about preempting, and it's also interesting you were saying about Monty Python, and it's also interesting you were saying about Hugh Laurie, because last night I was watching one of the UK channels, mm-hmm. A documentary on Fawlty Towers.
Right.
And as I was watching it, I was suddenly hit about how much of the approach to physical comedy and physical reactions that Hugh Laurie has, which you can see or appears you can see in John Cleese, particularly in Fawlty Towers.
Yeah.
A lot of the expressions and reactions, and obviously the pratfalls, I think you can see, I mean, it could be just coincidence. I think you can see that sort of, there seems to be some sort of connection there, whether there was or not, I don't know, but I never really noticed that before. But there's a lot of things, especially how Fawlty will react to Sybil isn't horrendously different to the sort of shock looks that Hugh Laurie will give George giving to Blackadder. And that's where I started to see the, you know, the comparatives, maybe. Yeah.
Now, have you seen the Specsavers advert? Have you seen the Specsavers advert with John Cleese?
I have. I really wish they'd stop doing those sort of things. You know, I mean, something in the documentary, and this, I suppose, could inform whatever debates we talk about in this podcast, that, you know, why they didn't do a third series of Fawlty Towers. And he was sort of saying that, you know, expectations would have been so high by the third, you know, it was pointless doing it. Why not just, you devalue the one and two by doing the third? And there's a certain truth to that. And when I saw that he'd done their little return on stage, him and Manuel, and that looked terrible. And then there was this advert, which wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
No, I agree. I didn't think it was as bad as I was expecting.
But there is a certain lack of vibrancy. As I've always said, aside from a couple of comedians, aging comedians I don't know. It never seems to work particularly well. They never. I can think of very few comedians who've got funnier as they've got older.
Yeah, well, Peter Cook had that problem as well, didn't he?
Stuart Lee's one of the few that I can. I think didn't reinvent himself, but modified himself.
Yeah.
To work as an older comedian, and well, I've not seen him do that.
Hey, another thing that Brian's going to be completely bewildered about, and the voice. Right, I'm not going to go on about. Reformat the podcast, start talking about reality shows. But on last night's edition of the Voice, Kerry called me down. Bernie Clifton, of all people, was on it.
Oh my God!
Yeah, totally. Bernie Clifton, Brian, was a guy who used to half dress up as an ostrich and pretend he was riding the ostrich.
Oh, good Lord! This goes back a bit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and it was a good act. But he was singing on The Voice, and he had a very good voice. Unfortunately, no one picked him. And curiously, only one of them knew who he was. Now, fair enough, Will.i.am's on The Voice. But strangely, I thought it was strange that Boy George didn't know who he was. It was only Ricky Wilson knew. But anyway, podcasterites, there is a hell of a lot of new stuff coming this year. And we, as you may know, we're quite excited about all of it. And but before we get on with the other stuff, Doctor Who, Stephen Moffat, Peter Capaldi, both talking about moving on in a kind of almost in unison, in a way that they haven't really talked about before, have they?
No.
Mm-mm.
And now, I mean, I don't know about you guys. I suspect you may agree with me. I'm a little bit disappointed that Capaldi is
perhaps, I'm with you on that,
not going to be taken along with the next showrunner.
Yeah, I would really love to see. But I said the same thing about Matt Smith, too. As a matter of fact, I even said the same thing about David Tennant. I would love to see what the three of them could have been like under a different showrunner rather than their whole era be under the same one. So, yeah, I would love to see him stay on and just get a different chance, get a different spin on his era. I think in a way it helps. I mean, look at Tom Baker. It helps, like, revitalize their era and their character and what their storytelling capability is able to do. So I think it would be a great thing. It's a shame to see him have to move on. Yeah. If it's his choice, it's a shame to see him choose to move on. If it's not his choice, it's a shame to see him have to move on.
Reading the comments in the on the letters page in the most recent Doctor Who magazine, it does seem that people have a high regard for Peter Capaldi. It's strange that it doesn't seem to be reflected in. And I say it's a shame and it's strange, but you know we're entering the season of you know award ceremonies, which itself is a sort of like a strange sort of netherworld of unreality. Anyway, but it does seem to me that it doesn't seem to be getting the recognition that he deserves as the Doctor.
You know. I think it's kind of like half and half, really, because some people like really seem to love him and other people just aren't getting it. But I think it comes down to what we said before. Mainly it's the writing, because most people I see that I talk with anyway, they like him and they would just like to see him get better stories better situations, you know. But maybe he isn't. But that said, I see videos floating around the internet where he sends messages to fans and a lot of them are just like, the fans rather that are seeing them and commenting on them, they're just saying things like, this man is perfect, why can't he stay forever kind of thing. So yeah. I think fans love him. I think either the BBC are failing to see that, or he's just feeling, you know, maybe it's not for him anymore, just the way the show's going, who knows. I'd love to know which one it is. I assume it's that when Moff moves on, they're just wanting to move him on too.
Yeah,
which is a shame. But
well, it's entirely possible that, sorry, Brian, there's a recent announcement by the BBC that they're going to be shipping stuff. I think we touched on this in the last podcast. Shipping stuff out, allowing external companies to pitch and bid on producing the BBC's usually produced in-house stuff. May have something to do with this. What do you think, James?
The BBC Studios is still looking like a very big chance. So whether stuff will get shipped out, or whether stuff will be moved to the commercial BBC Worldwide umbrella and work within studios there, I think is what's considered to be the more, is considered of high potential. And obviously that's something which certain independents, it has its contentions at the BBC. I don't know.
Okay. So, there's clearly changes afoot within Doctor Who in the next few months. We should find out what's going on. The only thing that we know, really, is that Series 10 will kick off production in the summer. I think it's going to be late summer and start. We suspect, we don't know this for sure. We do, but we're not allowed to say why. With the Christmas episode, which will obviously mean that Doctor Who is on air in 2016, if only for 1 hour. Obviously, things will develop and change slightly, but that seems to be the plan at the moment, and then a series to follow around the springtime in 2017. So we're essentially looking at a gap year this year. If
what would be the point of that?
Be believed. Well, just, I think, to shift production around. This is all I can think of. And also, there's Sherlock coming along.
Is that definitely confirmed?
No, of course.
As far as I'm aware, Sherlock's production in a couple of months.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, but the rest is confirmed. Or
no, it's not. No, it's not confirmed. That's why I said that this is just rumoured, and we don't really know how we know this, except we don't really.
Well, no, it's just I've never heard you sort of suggest that before.
Oh, that's because we haven't talked.
Well, no, we haven't talked for a couple of weeks. No, but
So, obviously we'll see how that all pans out. A little bit early to say for definite, but I mean, it does seem extremely likely that Sherlock is going into production in a couple of weeks at the earliest, and certainly within the next couple of months. Speaking of Sherlock, did you guys watch the seasonal Sherlock special?
I am sort of 55 minutes through it, and I've been finding it hard to get 55
minutes. Was it Matchsticks time at 55 minutes? Was that about Matchsticks time?
I don't know what Matchsticks time is.
That's when you need something to keep your eyes open.
Oh, I see. It's not boring. I mean, it's well done. I've been thinking, I mean, after the last time we were on and we were talking about, you know, the difficulties of reviewing stuff and trying to, you know, not become, appear territorial or judgmental. And you know, that still sort of plagues me a lot. I mean, we've all worked on projects, all three of us, and we've all worked nothing on the scale of the projects that we end up talking about. And we know how frustrating it can be when you get people who criticize it, who have not spent a year, 2 years working on something, who are just sitting in a chair and giving their opinion, and even to some degree look like they're using your hard work to showcase and platform their own product, which in a sense, arguably, that is in a sense what reviewing does. It's what we do to a degree, not out of ego, but it's the service we provide. Our service only exists because we can talk about what other people are doing. And sometimes that sort of gets to me. And because I keep thinking, you know, it must be hard, whether you're Stephen Moffat, Mark Gatiss, the guy who runs whatever show, and you get all these comments, and you can sort of sometimes, do you ever get that where you sometimes hit that sort of empathy trap where you suddenly feel for those people despite whatever position or whatever you think of them, and you think it must be so bloody irritating to listen to these people in what you'd probably consider, and I'd probably say the same thing, in their basements or whatever, making all these comments. It's the way it is. It's the way the industry works.
I must admit, I had to had a bit of a brief tussle with my conscience, but fortunately I won.
But I mean, we all get it. I mean, this is, I suppose, in the end what I'm trying to say is that I suppose it's an acknowledgement that what we do can be frustrating to those people who work on these things, which is why I think I've always said, if you're one of those people working on these things, you shouldn't be listening to this show, because it's not for you and it's only going to frustrate you, because we're not going to say what you want to hear, and what we hear, what we say might not be what you agree with, or it might not even be right compared to what you know. So why listen to it?
Right. Well, listen.
Anyway, with Sherlock, I was just thinking, I don't...
Well, listen, right, take it back to what we saw a few months ago. When we saw that minute clip from the bit where they go into 221B Baker Street, and it's all very, look at me, this is funny. How did the episode expand from that? Were you satisfied with that? Did you? Because that gave us a kind of a distinct sense of dread, which I don't think carried into the episode, which had some very, very good moments.
Well, it's still... I think the problem for me, the two problems I had with it, and again, this is personally my problem, is one, I think Sherlock under Stephen Moffat, Gatiss and Cumberbatch and Freeman and all becomes its own entity. While it is Sherlock Holmes, it's not. It's its own product. And as soon as you move it into the Victorian era, it neither feels like Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, because it has the staple markings of Sherlock. And so it doesn't really exist in either. I think Cumberbatch is really good in Sherlock. As Sherlock Holmes, he seems less interesting in a weird way. He doesn't seem quite as powerful as he does in the contemporary version. And I don't know whether that's because I'm used to him in the brand of Sherlock, or whether it's because he just doesn't seem as odd or out of odds as in a Victorian world, and thus seems less powerful. I don't know whether it's just I look at it and I think I'd rather watch Jeremy Brett, and I don't know. So there's that problem with it. And I think there is a certain problem that the show has this sort of tension between sort of trying to sort of say, hey, we can do what Conan Doyle did, but better. And at the same time, obviously respecting and loving Conan Doyle. So it has this sort of weird sort of tension between sort of embracing and wanting to do it justice, and at the same time wanting to almost feel like it's trying to outdo it, and even sort of makes comments, almost snide comments or jokey comments or meta comments at the material itself. So in itself, it almost becomes the reviewer in the basement of the Sherlock Holmes Conan Doyle, making its own commentary.
That's what I was thinking of when you started talking about that a few minutes ago, actually.
I mean, that's why I don't feel bad about what we do, because we all do it within the industry in some way or another, or outside the industry. But I think it's always good to be aware of it anyway. So, yeah, no, I've not finished it, so I can't say for sure. But it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
And when I say bad, I mean compared to the comedy.
You mean good, like Michael Jackson?
No.
Okay.
From the trailer, the trailer to me looked like something I couldn't bear to watch.
Yeah.
Well, the show, as you say, is far better than that. It's very slick. It's very well put together. If you're a Sherlock fan, I think you'd find bits in it that you'll really enjoy if you've not watched it, which I'm sure you have if you're a Sherlock fan. I kind of felt you didn't need all the faces from Sherlock in there personally, but I found putting the mortuary good woman in there, as a man, didn't work for me. But yeah. Mm. What about you lot? I'm talking too much today.
Well, the problem is, if I say something, I'm going to spoil it for you. So
yeah, that's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Did you watch it all, Brian?
No. And not for lack of trying. I did try to watch it. I was just extremely tired when it aired, because I watched it on the actual BBC airing the original night, and it was a long day. And I saw the beginning. I saw the beginning up to, I don't know, a fair-ish point, and then I caught the very end. So I need to go back and still catch up on it. But I do agree with James in that, from what I hear and from what I saw, it was well done. But I agree with James because, my thing was, why, when you take a show that flipped the format of Sherlock, like, upside down and created it in a modern way and found, like, brilliant modern ways to unfold the story and use technology, do you go ahead and go back to the old format when you only get 3 episodes a year? And, you know, that's actually 3 episodes every, 2-3 years, I guess I should say. You know, and then here we get this Christmas story, which brings it right back to its roots, which just seemed like the whole polar opposite of what the show was doing in the first place. What I saw was good. Everything I hear is good. So I'm not complaining because it was, you know, when I watch it, I'll probably feel the same. But I just don't understand why they needed to go ahead and mess with the format that they had already messed with.
That being said, what I do like about it, and I wish they would do a Doctor Who, is even though, okay, it wasn't on at Christmas, it wasn't locked into the seasonal period as a theme, as far as I remember, having only watched it most of it this morning. It's not like, you know, every Doctor Who episode, because it's on Christmas Day, as we've said this before, has to be about Christmas. It was nice to have something which had a quirk for the season, but wasn't a quirk that had to be related to the season.
Yeah.
Unless it ends in a large Christmas thing that I'm unaware of.
Well, it certainly proved popular on TV, Sherlock.
This was another thing that was interesting to me. So carry on, yeah.
Yeah, so this 11.6 million viewers watched it on BBC One or on Catch Up, which is, you know, we're nearly in double Doctor Who territory there.
So what could we say about this? And again, this is in broad terms. And one of the things I would say if I was going to do my backseat commentary and frustrate those who work in Doctor Who if they listen to this.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Is this an example of a show which has, as a special, has made itself very, very open for people to watch? It stands alone, so you don't have to watch Sherlock. It taps into a popular theme of Victorian Britain. And it's not doesn't require continuity to watch it.
It could well be. I think. I mean, we said this before. I think continuity was a problem for Doctor Who in Series 9. But yeah, I think it. You know, it's got a strange sort of fandom around it, hasn't it?
But this is more than a fandom, though. 11 million people.
Oh yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Not a fandom.
Yeah.
That's what I mean is,
I think they're doing the job on social media that maybe Doctor Who fans aren't doing. On social
well, that's
media.
An interesting comment. So, how do you mean by that?
Well, I think that they're more positive about Sherlock than Doctor Who fans are about Doctor Who. So, when it comes to sharing, you know, clips and trailers and reminding people that it's on and all that sort of stuff, perhaps it's working in a different way for Sherlock than it is for Doctor Who.
Hmm.
It's certainly worth spending some time considering. Not by us, but by the people at the top, in how Doctor Who's been engaged online. Now, I mean, I was watching with Bruce earlier. We were watching the Lazarus Experiment. I like the Lazarus Experiment, but I know it isn't a standout episode for a lot of people. But watching that alongside some of the more disappointing episodes of late, I would much rather watch the Lazarus Experiment than
I agree.
Say Eye Jelly or. Or Danny dies and then gets turned into a Cyberman alongside the Brigadier.
Yeah.
Either of those. Lazarus Experiment is far better. And it cannot be purely down to the fact that this is a fast-paced 45-minute episode, because compared to the episode that follows it, 42, it is not a fast-paced 45-minute episode, is it? And yet it still seems a lot pacier than Doctor Who in the last 12 months. Now, I know we've chatted on the podcast before, and maybe we were wrong, and maybe there was a problem with what we were saying, or maybe it was the approach at the BBC Wales. But, you know, we talked about wanting Doctor Who to maybe slow down a bit. But I think when Doctor Who does slow down in Series 9 with Capaldi on his own episode,
Heaven Sent,
it's absolutely fantastic. So that can't be what the problem is. But, they're clearly different eras of the show, but there's something about watching the Lazarus Experiment which was just so much more fun than watching, and maybe that is the word, maybe that is the problem, so much more fun than watching some of Moffat's era's recent offerings.
If you want to try and look at things which are different between the two, I mean, the first very obvious difference, Lazarus Experiment, to a lot of... the Stephen Moffat era, is the fact that you've got a chief antagonist, which you don't tend to have.
Well, that's something that we talked about that I'd raised a few weeks ago, isn't it? In Doctor Who these days, it never focuses on the monsters unless it's the Daleks or the Cybermen or the classic.
Otherwise,
monsters.
It's an elemental or
exactly
unthinking force.
Yeah, exactly. But there's never that focus on the monster or the villain that there was in classic Doctor Who. Lazarus Experiment being a rarity. Again, with the Master episodes, those are also rarities. But yeah, do carry on.
No, I think you're right. I think it's some sort of neo-literary approach that where people just don't want to engage on something which can become as, I don't know, pantomime or farcical or binary as having, you know, an antagonist to a protagonist. So they like to try and find new ways of approaching things where people are having to deal with things wider than just, an opposing person. And I think perhaps that's gone too far.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
To a point where you no longer got that conflict again, which is what possibly makes Sherlock maybe more accessible to a lot of people, because it's a far more simpler approach of you've always pretty much got an enemy, you just got to uncover them.
Yeah, and they always seem to talk a lot as well. Brian?
Yeah, no, sorry. I was going to say it's interesting that you're pointing that out, because that's something I had said about Moff stories in Russell's era before, where there really wasn't an antagonist. It was more so just an accidental happenstance of some sort, or technology. Creatures that didn't understand or technology, exactly.
But that was fresh at the time because it was fairly rare. So you, like the empty child has felt quite unusual at the end.
It was fresh at the time, but then, Doctor Who.
If you pop over to Star Trek universe.
Oh, God, yeah, no, yeah, absolutely.
Well, sure. But also it was fresh at the time for Doctor Who, but then like Russell's era and Moffat's era now, it got stale as it happened every year, you know, because you have the nanobots from the one you just mentioned, of course, lost in my brain right now.
Thank you.
And then you also have the Vashta Narada, which, you know, like basically they were only there because somebody cut down their forests.
Yeah.
You know,
in the same episode, you've got a library's computer system backing up all the people in the library as well. So technology again.
Oh, well, yes, exactly. And I mean, you know, Blink was a bit of a different one, but then it wasn't really until you get to series five, it's not really a villain that you could talk with, you know, that you could actually have any kind of great dialogue with, any kind of insight from.
Oh, I think the problem is with villains. I imagine the problem with villains is that to be a villain of a level that Doctor Who deals with, you have to be fairly fantastical in your motivations, as you do in any of these sort of shows, any sort of high concept show, be they sort of Gotham, Batman, whatever. And that can be quite. Maybe there's a fear from writers, and not that they can't do it, but an uncomfortability in having to try and make that feel real.
But they did it 40 years ago, didn't they? And most of the current viewing audience aren't aware of what was happening 40 years ago.
Absolutely, but it's a different sort of era of television where perhaps those sort of villains they fear might not fit into the sort of style and expectations of today's audiences, that they would be too Machiavellian, too pantomime, too unbelievable. I'm not saying that that's right. I'm not saying that. It's just an idea. Uh-huh. I'm just trying to work out why it's sort of become unfashionable, especially since it's still fashionable in film and to a certain degree in television with superheroes. You know, Daredevil, Avengers, Batman. You've still got these. James Bond. You still always have quintessential villains, and yet Doctor Who seems to be uncomfortable with doing that now.
Yeah. Well, listen, another show that doesn't focus so much on the villains, but does, unless the villain is a main character, but does spend a lot of time on its three leads, is Ripper Street.
Yeah.
Which is back this Friday.
It is, yeah.
And now they've said there's going to be a fifth series after this, and then that's it.
That's a shame.
Well, it is a shame, but it's probably time that they all did something different. But so that's going to be on Amazon Instant. Are you looking forward to that, James?
I am, yes. I have Amazon, so I'm going to be watching that this year. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that a great deal.
Indeed. Brian, did you catch any Ripper Street 3?
No, I still have to catch up. I'm dying to catch up. I didn't realize how far behind I was, actually. But I really enjoyed Series 1 and Series 2. But that is one thing I do want to comment on, you saying that they're looking at Series 5 and then ending it. And that was one thing that I've said for years that I wish America would catch up on, which is a show should end when it feels right to end and not milk it for all its ratings. And I don't know. A lot of the shows that I love seem to peter off at the end rather than end strong. Yeah. Whereas a lot of the British shows seem to end very strong because they realize this is where it should stop.
They all want to get back in the theatre as well.
Yes, British mentality. Yeah.
British actors always want to work in the theatre. Yeah. They do TV to pay the mortgage, but what they really want to do is tread the boards every night. Generally speaking,
I think there's that, and I think there is the. I think our industry isn't so so commercially bent that they don't plan for these long series, so it gives the series more flexibility so when people on the series are tired, because as we know television series is a very arduous process
not so much in the USA, but yeah, go on, that one's easy.
My point being this is my point, productions do get tired, but studios push them on. It's, you know, the studios will offer the lucrative contracts, will offer a longer period contract, or try and tie people into longer period contracts to hold them into shows, which you don't do over here. So by year, people involved assess it, and after a few years, people do get fatigued out. In they, as you say, they want to go and do other things, so they go and do things. I wonder whether the model of the US industry allows production to actually do that as easy, and if they didn't have such a more commercially controlled market, maybe they'd be doing the same. Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's not just the boards. I think you're right there, Christian. I think for the actors, especially, there's that. But I wonder whether there is a sort of little less pressure on productions to perpetuate, so they have the ability to decide when they finish, rather than being motivated to do more until, as you say, they burn out. I don't know. I'm just, again, this is the podcast of guesswork.
The podcast of guesswork, we may call it that. Listen, one of the shows we've mentioned repeatedly on the podcast is Blake 7. And obviously it has its audio life on Big Finish, as it should. Another show that was revived by Big Finish, The Prisoner. It seems that Ridley Scott's going to be directing a movie of The Prisoner. There is a script, apparently, by... who's it by? William Monaghan, who wrote The Departed. And apparently Ridley Scott wants to do this, as well as everything else that he's doing. Which includes a Prometheus sequel and a new Alien movie. So that'll be interesting how that turns out, and if Big Finish get any kind of benefit from that in terms of popularity of the show. Strange show, The Prisoner. It was one I was never able to kind of get into properly, because when I was watching that sort of TV, it was on late at night, and I think it was a Thursday night or a Monday night. I can't recall now. Back when I was in college, I think. What about you,
James? Tristan, I only watched a few episodes. It's never been something I've particularly got locked into.
I did watch the remake, the American remake with Gandalf.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem as bad as some of the reviews were making it out to be. But what about you, Brian? Do you have any Prisoner exposure?
No, I haven't. People have told me to check it out for years, but I haven't so far done so. I tried once, but it wasn't. I wasn't able to find it where they said I could find it. It was originally, I think, it was on Netflix for a little while, and then it wasn't there when I went to go look for it. So then I tried looking for DVDs and so on, but kind of never really kept it. Never kept the search active as other shows I'd like to look for, I guess.
Yeah. Okay then. Now, guys, how far are we from the X-Files?
Man, it's only a couple of weeks now.
February, I think, for the UK.
Right.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's no fun. Okay. For us over here, it's the 24th, so we're right now, as of recording the podcast, we're 2 weeks away.
Wow.
I think we're a week after, so I think it's beginning of February.
Right. I thought we were a day after, but I might be thinking...
I could be wrong. It was just a colleague of mine posted on Facebook.
I might be thinking of Game of Thrones, which is also the 24th. That's the 24th of April.
Well, are they airing two episodes one day after the other for you guys? Because we have January 24th is episode one, and the 25th is episode two, which was previously listed as episode five, but I think that was just production-wise. But yeah, so they're doing which I kind of find weird, to be honest, although they're talking about it like it's a two-episode premiere rather than like a two-night premiere, so the episodes may be more linked than they led us on to believe, because originally they were supposed to be mythology for episode one, standalone for episode two. But I find it a little odd because it's a miniseries that only has six episodes, and essentially you're knocking it down to a five-week event rather than a six-week event by putting the first two episodes together, and I'm just a little surprised by that.
What's the promotion been like for it?
From what I'm hearing, people are saying TV promotion is not very large, but the internet, it's all over Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I mean, you name it. They're using all sorts of social media platforms. Tumblr's in there as well. And so there's a lot of buzz. There's huge buzz. As a matter of fact, they needed just the other day, they needed Skinner, the actor who plays Skinner, Mitch Pileggi, and they had done this previously with Gillian Anderson, they posted an X on their Twitter page. And if they got 5,000 retweets, they were going to release a special teaser video.
Right.
And it didn't take them long to get those 5,000 retweets, not long at all. You know, like it was within half an hour to an hour or something like that. It was ridiculous.
Okay. See, I don't want teaser videos. This is what always gets me. Surely, There was a, there were, I saw a video review or a video commentary on Cracked that was sort of suggesting that people, that some reports, some science, some studies, I've not checked the studies out, so I can't verify this, have suggested that people actually prefer, enjoy a viewing of a film or television more if they've had spoilers than if they don't. And I still can't buy that. I still, to me, the X-Files would be far more interesting the less I know of it.
I think this teaser video would probably be something you would get behind, because it was, they did similar with Jillian, and what it was you know, it's just the actor sitting in the chair saying, hey, look, you know, we're not supposed to talk about what's going on here. They don't let us, but I think I can show you this. And they quite literally rapid fire like 20 to 25 photos at you of the revival. And then they just come back and are like, hey, pretty cool, right? You know, so it's just getting you enticed, like, damn it, man, I want to see all of those in slow motion, please. You know, so they're not really like spoiling scenes or anything. I do agree, though, that a lot has come out. And I know Chris Carter was not happy with the fact that episode one has had premieres. I think the earliest one was in November, might have been October, but I think it premiered in November at New York Comic Con. Prior to that, it had premiered in France, and then they're doing an LA premiere as well. And, you know, basically for the last X-Files movie, they really had like a whole spoiler campaign going. They fed false information on the internet so that people wouldn't really know what was going on with the stories. They had their scripts printed on red paper so that you couldn't Xerox copy them. They really wanted to keep secrets away from people. This way, you know, going into it spoiler free, you had no idea what to expect. You could just watch a story for the first time and enjoy it, not knowing what was coming. This time they didn't really have that same approach, but Chris was saying with all these premieres, you know, and the way the internet works today, as far as he's concerned, everybody's already seen episode one. So he's more excited for them to watch 2 through 6 now, because even though only a small handful of people actually got to watch them, you can look up spoilers from them online within 2 seconds. So,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's too much out there, but
I haven't seen any promotion for it offline at all. Now, I suspect it's possibly because Channel 5 isn't on in our house particularly often. I doubt it's on in many people's houses particularly often, to be fair. So it'll be strange. It'll be interesting to see what figures it actually gets, I feel.
You know, I hope it does well. I really do. And I think the buzz, like what I'm saying with the internet buzz right now, I guess I'll put it this way. That Mitch Pileggi video went up yesterday and it's got 9,755 views. Jillian's went up a month ago and it's at 109,000 views. You know, there's a lot of buzz, and it looks like those things are doing well. This other video went up a week ago and it was a behind the scenes look, a 20-minute behind the scenes look, and it's got 853,000 views.
But the question is that the thing is, and this is where I think it all becomes interesting, are these sort of shows, I mean, The X-Files was made for a niche audience in its conception.
Yeah.
Do they have just an extremely dedicated fan base? And does that dedication or that interest extend beyond it? So you get a fan base which is massively behind it,
yeah,
in a way that Doctor Who probably isn't, in the sense that as soon as there's Doctor Who stuff coming out, it's a 5-year break. The people from 5 years before or even 20 years before might not be so interested because it's not going to be their era, so they won't be so invested or won't check it out.
Yeah.
You know, are X-Files people far more behind their show in the way that Christian was suggesting with Sherlock, that they ramp these figures within their social media spheres because they're so dedicated? But does that, will that,
I think that's very
expand
likely,
out,
yes,
from, I don't know. I'm,
yeah,
just,
no, I think the fan base is huge enough for it. Like, what you have to remember is one of the reasons they keep saying the X-Files has come back for this 6-episode series is because of all of the views and hits that it had gotten on Netflix. You know, Fox looked at that and saw how popular the show was doing. And one thing you do have to remember about that too is it's not just old fans that were watching it. It was people who were getting turned on to it by those old fans, similar to the way Doctor Who was. So I do think the show has potential to reach new viewers, because I think that's what's happening on Netflix nearly every day. Certainly a lot of people I know are going through it right now for the first time. But the question is, will these 6 episodes be enough to draw in new viewers alone? Because a lot of the people I know are catching up on the series because they were told how good it was, in a similar way that we just talked about checking out The Prisoner. You know, we basically, fans turn other fans on to things and just get them interested and stuff. I think the fan base is huge enough that it brought it back, and I think it's huge enough that it will make it be a successful return. But will it be a successful enough return to bring in enough new viewers and make the show as number one as it was before? Because X-Files was really number one at the time when it came out, not just number one on Fox, but then it was really the biggest hit in America.
The fans were as dedicated when X-Files 2 came out, and that film did not do very well. So again, yeah. That's what I mean is that will I'll be interested to see whether that avant and faithful, loyal and loving fan base of the show translates beyond that.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a difference in that when you're looking at X-Files 2, they were trying to market that not only at fans but at new viewers. Same thing that they're doing with this miniseries. But the difference is that with a movie, I mean, this is going to be the same way. This is going to be the same kind of feeling. But with a movie, you have fans that are interested, like, oh, I've heard about that. I should check it out. But, you know, I don't know anything about the past. I'm not going to go pay to go sit and watch a 2-hour movie that I'm going to be lost on. You know, whereas this is a TV show. If they're curious to check it out to get a hint, all they have to do is sit down and watch it for free. You know, especially since it's on network TV, you don't need anything special to watch it, you know. And I think that plays into part of it. Plus, the other part of it was when fans got word that the last movie didn't have anything to do with the mythology, a lot of people just backed out from even wanting to watch it. And I think that kind of harmed it there as well. They were upset that it wasn't going to continue. It wasn't going to be the story that they wanted it to be.
It was also summer months in a period where there was a lot of big blockbuster movies that was wedged between. So, I mean, I'm not saying they're identical situations.
That's a very good point, though, actually, because it should have been the big blockbuster movie. It should have been about colonization. It should have been that huge film that everybody wanted, and it would have slotted in perfectly with those big summer blockbusters, like you said. But unfortunately, they chose to tell a lighter, more heartfelt tale, which just, exactly like you said, didn't have a place in those summer months. And I think that certainly hurt it as well. So that's a very good point.
Okay.
It'll be interesting to see what happens, though. I'm very curious to see if it. I mean, they're calling it a revival. It'll be interesting to see if it actually revives it in the way that it once was. I don't expect that'll be the case. But if it gets another miniseries out of it, I'd be quite happy with that.
Okay. Well, I think we'll all be watching X-Files, and probably you will too, dear listener. There's a hell of a lot of other stuff coming along in 2016. However, there's a third series of The Musketeers. For instance, you may recall that Peter Capaldi jumped ship after the first series, which had where he was the villain, and he was replaced by Mark Warren in the second series as a new antagonist. Third series, Rupert Everett, with his new face, is turning up as King Louis's wicked brother, so that'll be interesting. And there's also another series for Fumans, which is Channel 4's synthetic... I don't want to say it's Channel 4's version of Blade Runner, but it's basically, there's synthetic people in that, and it's a good show. So that's worth keeping an eye on as well. And Red Dwarf 11 will be along on Dave later in the year as well.
Classy channel, that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. And currently, Midsummer Murders is back. Had to mention that,
also, for those who are looking for, as I was saying, class, Father Brown is currently airing. I've not seen any of them yet, but I'm looking forward to that.
That's an afternoon thing, isn't it?
Talk about class here.
No, don't talk about class. Father Brown is a strange scheduling, isn't it?
Well, as I said, I mean, initially it was a taster thing, as they were looking to start trying to put decent dramas that could, you know, slot through Doctors. And I think they seem to, from what I was told at the time, that they did this initial run in the first series of doing them all in January as an idea to see how it sat in that time slot, and then that became the way it went. So you just sort of have 10-13 episodes, one a day over 2 weeks, then it's done. So really, really weird. But it's on Netflix now. First series is on Netflix, right. So it's expanding outwards. It's a good show.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of them. Yeah.
Did you see the one that was they had? I can't remember what it's called. It's an Australian one where they have Henry from Neighbours.
No, McLaughlin.
Yeah, Craig McLaughlin plays the lead detective. He's an Australian detective. It's very, very similar feel to Father Brown. It fits the slot perfectly.
Right. No, I haven't seen that. No.
Have to locate his name. But anyway, so Father Brown's back. this year, which I think is worth mentioning. I suppose we should also mention on the list...
Death in Paradise as well, which has already started.
Yes, Death in Paradise, oh, cool. Paradise started. Class as well, we've enjoyed got this that. Year.
Do we have to keep talking about Class?
Yeah, let's forget that Class even exists. Well, let's talk about Death in Paradise again, because that's actually a good show. Like, I've seen Class, but I just can't imagine it being good. It's a children's show about a children in a school.
Now, look.
Fun times.
We've got to take our position here seriously. We've not seen it. We can't judge it. It could be the best thing. I mean, can
okay,
you think
you're
of shows
right. We haven't seen it, so we can't judge it. But the other thing is we don't have to judge it. How about that?
Can you think of any shows that you really thought were going to be terrible, which you watched and thought, oh, my God, this is actually really good stuff?
Game of Thrones.
Fringe.
Who's going first?
Yeah.
Well, I'll expand on it. When I first started watching Game of Thrones, it had Sean Bean in it. I thought that I knew that he wasn't in it beyond the first series, so I kind of thought, well, it's going to be crap after he's finished. Something's going to happen. It's going to go way off downhill. How wrong could I be? It absolutely. I mean, it stepped up to the next gear, if anything, with the second series and stuff like that. So yeah, Game of Thrones. I started off with some considerable apprehension.
Well, just shows how bad you two are actually assessing shows, because every show I watch is exactly as I expected.
Oh, I see how it is.
Yeah. Okay, go on, Brian. Why were you not sure about Fringe?
Well, you know, I actually was interested in watching it at first, and I thought, okay, well, here we go. X-Files is gone. It's been a little while. It's been gone. This show is a similar kind of theme. Maybe it'll be good. I'll check it out. I'm a little worried that maybe they're just going to copy what was done before, but let's check it out. I couldn't get through the pilot episode, and I tried four different times.
Right.
I just felt that the characters, I don't know if it was the writing and the acting combined, probably so, with the directing as well. It just felt like the characters were all trying to be characters. You know how like everybody has to be somebody special or interesting or quirky now rather than just being someone normal, you know?
Yeah.
It seemed like they were all trying to be this personality that they wanted them to be right off the bat rather than developing into that character and just let them be. And I tried four times and I just couldn't get into it. And finally, one day I was just home. I was bored. And I said, you know what? Let me try again. And I have no idea what happened. But all of a sudden, the show just clicked with me. I got past the pilot episode and I watched all the seasons. And it really was a damn good show. So, yeah, I don't know why it was, but it just wasn't working for me before.
Well, I mean, I found the first one fairly easy to watch. And then I've watched about three since on Netflix. And I've found it harder per episode to care. Finding that with Supernatural as well, actually. I've been trying that, and three, four episodes in. I know it's meant to get a lot better, but I'm finding that. I think it's just dating for some of these shows. I mean, Fringe is an older, fairly old show now. Supernatural even more so. And I think when you start watching things on video on demands that are old, sometimes, unfortunately, that can sort of make it harder to consume.
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing with Fringe that won me was eventually the show turns into a big base of the show is alternate reality rather than just rather than the X-Files. It wasn't really a show based in the paranormal. It was a show based on fringe science. So everything that was done was really done because man had made it somehow, you know, rather than paranormal aspects where the world had made it. You know, people did this kind of stuff to themselves. So when they brought in alternate realities, that just won me over hugely because I'm a big fan of alternate reality stories. And they didn't really take it to the extremes that I had hoped that they would, but they did take it pretty far, which was kind of cool. One thing that got me about it, though, in the respect of dating, like you said, you know, The X-Files was the show that first utilized cell phones as part of a main story kind of device to keep their characters connected. And they did other things like that with technology. But it always just seemed like in the show, we can look at it now and just say it's dated because look how big those phones are kind of thing. But with Fringe, watching the show one day and seeing seeing one of the leads press the button on their steering wheel and say like, you know, call Fringe Division. It was very strange to see that somebody was actually utilizing that in a show because even now that it's been around forever, I still don't see it used in movies or TV shows. So when Fringe
really
was shot,
works
that,
very
that
well.
Was,
that's why probably.
Well, true, but you know, but it was new technology at the time, and that was one of the things they had this car. It was on loan from that car company. They had to show that feature kind of thing, and it really helped date it because one of the other things was at one point, all of a sudden, they're using FaceTime to talk to each other, and it was just like, man, I never see this done. You know, like it's only done in like cheesy horror movies or something, but. It was such a weird thing to watch that show and just like whenever they would show some kind of cell phone technology, the car technology like that, it was always like, well, now I know when this technology became new just by watching this particular episode, you know? So yeah, it was a little bit dated in that respect for me, but otherwise I felt it held up pretty well.
Listen, it's probably worth just mentioning Midsommar again, because I can't remember what series they're up to, but they've cast their first Asian character as first Asian recurring character. They obviously had Asian and black and whatever characters previously, but first recurring character, they've recast the role of the pathologist. That's now played by an Asian lady. That's garnered a few column inches in the UK. But the reason I mention it is not because of that, which obviously it's a thing that needs to be mentioned, but the supporting actor, Gwilym Lee, who plays the new Detective Sergeant as of the last series, I think he's a guy to watch out for. I think he's a really good actor. So that's just my thing. I think he's going to be, helming his own show within the next 5 years or so. He's a very good actor. He's possibly slightly wasted on Midsommar, but he's very good in Midsommar as well, obviously.
Is that the guy that took over from Ben Jones, character-wise?
Yeah.
Okay, guy, yeah, cool. I liked him. I thought he was pretty good.
Yeah, he was good, yeah. So, so that's back on the airwaves. The airwaves? Is it the 50s? Guys, have we got anything else that we jotted down that we were going to talk about this week?
I think the only thing that I think is quite interesting, which I was talking, and you were present, I know, you nosy bastard, Christian, was conversation I talked with Alan Stevens about the Stephen Moffat's the only reason I bring it up because it chimes into some of the things that Brian was talking about at the time.
Before you do that,
yeah,
I just want to tell you that the entire Ask Stephen Moffat section in this month's Doctor Who magazine is explaining that episode.
Right.
Now we've obviously talked about this sort of thing before. And maybe we should have a placard outside BBC Wales that says, down with this sort of thing. I don't know. There's a Father Ted reference for you there. But should the writer, whether he's the showrunner or not, should the writer of an episode have to fill three columns in order to explain a story?
No.
No.
So, I'll tell you what. I was talking about this recently. I like when certain writers can fill in small blanks, just give you some, as they call it, headcanon nowadays, to help you just enjoy something a little bit more.
Yeah.
But when you have to explain your entire plot to people, that's too far. You know, especially when people are kind of like, you know, I like theories, I like fan theories, I like even when the writers come out and pop their own theories in there. But when you have to rely on them for understanding something that should have been explained in 1 hour TV show or a 2 hour movie, then that's not good. That should have been in the movie or the TV show, in my opinion.
And again, we all like Heaven Sent, don't we? So we're not dissing the episode or anything. So James, do go on.
Well, that was the interesting thing was, I mean, the question was, should they? I mean, it brings up loads of questions about how TV should be treated, because there's things in Heaven Sent, and this is what Alan Stevens was pointing out, and they're very valid points, that his answers don't still match up with what's in the show, to the point where you think, are these retrospective answers? Are these things which naturally weren't seen due to time or due to lack of peer review or whatever reason, and went in because simply they were good for the moment of the drama? And this is where I think it becomes very interesting, is where television sits. Is it still a sort of, you know, of the moment consumption sort of model where, you know, model is a stupid word, where it doesn't matter whether it really fits in the complexities of the stories, as long as it makes the moment and the audience will have consumed it, eaten it up, then they'll be on to the next TV show. So if you put Clara's picture on the wall of the room there, even if that causes a load of inconsistencies with your basic reset ideas or whatever, does it matter if it stops the show for a moment, gives the audience a bit of pathos with the hero about the loss of their friend? Does it matter? Does it make any sense? Should that have to be justified? Or should it make sense? Should writers have this all planned out a little better? Because television is consumed not just once and then on to the next show, but then over and over again in VOD formats or in DVDs. Can you get away with that? Should you be making something more watertight? I don't know. I think there's a lot of stuff you could talk about there. And I think it raises a lot of issues.
I'll put it to you this way. Like, all of us, as we said, we liked Heaven Sent. We thought it was Moff's strongest episode of his era, certainly the best Capaldi episode. From what I read of that article, I didn't see anything in there that I felt needed explaining. As a matter of fact, a lot of the things in that story that were left, that were left for us to draw our own conclusion on, I felt they were actually the perfect things to leave us to draw our own conclusion on, because it didn't need further explaining. We understood what was going on. There wasn't anything that left me going, but how did this work, or how did that work? Plot hole. I didn't feel that it needed it. So for that column to have been there, to me, was kind of pointless, whereas that episode did its job. There are other episodes in his era where he probably could have spent more time in an article explaining his huge plot holes, I think, personally. So for that one, no, I think he did a good job with it, as you said. You know, like, do they need to go into that much detail? Sometimes they do not, because sometimes it's not necessary, and it's very easy for the writer to let the viewer figure out what's going on. Other times, yeah, they do. And I think they just chose a bad one to do an article on, needing explaining, in my opinion.
Okay.
I mean, I still don't. I think what gets me a little about it is that it felt to me that his answers revised what the end product was saying.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole thing of a tighter loop each did not come across, and sort of goes against the whole episode is saying, not simply the fact that the Doctor endures the same thing over and over again for billions of years. Okay, technically doesn't endure it because he dies each time, but that there's this sort of nihilistic approach that actions are only responded by are only responses to environment, and if the environment's the same each time, you will do the same thing each time. But the Doctor subverts that to a point where, by doing it each time, that last moment changes the situation. So after billions of years, he breaks through this nihilistic concept through his own motivations. So that seemed to be the very power behind it. And suddenly these answers and excuses, if excuses is a bit too of a too-flavoured word, just seems to undermine what it was doing. And I think that's the problem with these sort of pieces, is that when you do explain everything, I think there's a tendency probably to revise naturally, and therefore change what you've got, and therefore change perception for audiences. I don't know. That's perhaps what gets me a bit about it.
Crikey, I mean, it's like starting a new podcast, really, isn't it?
It is a bit. I mean, I was just interested.
It's a minefield of a topic.
I mean, he did mention the clothes, podcast, which is what Brian mentioned originally. You know, was where did the clothes come from?
Yeah.
And that was one thing that we talked about and did seem to make sense, that the first loop was different.
Yeah, and that was even something. Here's the thing: in his article, he said the first loop was different, but we even gave that as an example in our podcast, so we understood that we didn't need that to be explained to us. I guess is my point. You know. Go on.
I was going to say, I mean, he does try and sort of suggest this is his interpretation, which is, in fairness, a good way of putting it. I think that's actually quite a nice way of saying, you know, I'm not trying to ruin this for you. You take what you want out of it.
It's certainly one of the nicest ways that he has responded to fans, because prior to that was about the Sonic sunglasses, where he essentially called fans stupid for not liking it. Whereas here he's like, you know, draw your own conclusion. This is just my opinion, which is much better. You know, hey, who knows? Maybe he's actually listening to our podcasts.
We know he is.
I know.
Hi. Okay, well, if he is listening, it's time to go and do something else.
Yes.
We're at the end of this week's podcast with a K, affiliated with no website other than thepodcast.co.uk. We'll be back next week. We may have a guest as well. Until then, it's goodbye.